This is The Guardian.
Sie führen täglich hitzige Fußballdebatten? Dann probieren Sie jetzt die Big Mac-Methode. Denn nur beim Big Mac sind sich alle einig.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Die Big Mac-Methode funktioniert auch mit dem Double Big Mac und Big Mac Bacon TS. Schlichte Diskussionen über Handspiel, Abseits, Videobeweis, Aufstellung, Taktik und Auswechslungen. Bei Ineffektivität wird keine Haftung übernommen. In allen teilnehmenden Restaurants. Nur solange der Vorrat reicht.
If you listen to people in the audience across the country more often, you might not be quite so out of touch.
And if you are not certain about Labour, don't surrender to them. Don't vote for any other party. Vote Conservative.
Will the welfare bill be higher?
They've been in power for 14 years. Why has he only just thought of this with a week to go before the general election? Honestly.
You want to be in charge, but you've got nothing to say to people about what you would do about it. This election is about the future.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
Pippa, we're back in your front room. And last time we were here also talking about one of the prime ministerial debates, I remember that off microphone, we were discussing a story that you were working on at the time, which was, and we weren't sure exactly how big a deal it was at the time, but it kind of became clear in the days following, about a certain Tory MP who'd placed a rather important bet on the date of the election.
That's right. Not just any Tory candidate either. This was Craig Williams, who was, of course, Rishi Sunak's closest parliamentary aide, who I wrote about after I found out that he had placed a £100 bet on the election date, the fact the election was going to be in July, just 3 days before Rishi Sunak had actually announced it, and as a result was the subject of a Gambling Commission inquiry. Now, when we first published this story, the immediate response I got from most people was like, oh my God, really? What an idiot. What's he doing? But most people thought it was going to be an isolated case. Of course, yeah. You'll remember from our conversation that night that we were already aware that there was likely to be others.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, over the following few days, in fact, the following 2 weeks, there's been more and more and more allegations out there, now involving, I think we're up to five Conservatives, two of whom are candidates, one of whom is a member of the Welsh Parliament, and two who are Conservative officials at CCHQ. And of course, the police as well. One of Sunak's parliamentary close protection officers has been arrested, in fact, and five other officers being investigated. So this scandal, as it now is, has dominated the election campaign over the last couple of weeks, has put the Prime Minister on even more of a back foot than he already has been. And frankly, with a week to go, looks set to continue overshadowing the campaign.
Yeah, there have been two types of bets placed, as far as I can tell. There are the ones where people may have had, and we don't know, but may have had inside information on when the election was going to be, and then placed a bet on the date. And then there are other people, including a Labour candidate, and now we know a Tory candidate, Philip Davis, a longstanding MP, who bet against themselves to lose their own constituencies. Now, the former you can obviously see as potentially very serious.
It's illegal, isn't it?
Illegal, you know, fraudulent insider trading. The latter seems kind of daft, but it's also the kind of thing where in sports you get into huge trouble for that because it gives you an incentive to not perform as well as you mm-hmm. might. Now, I don't suppose that was going to happen with these candidates. That's the kind of thing that probably falls more into the stupid category rather than the corrupt. But the question remains for a lot of these people who've placed bets, did they actually know the day? And I suspect that's where the police investigation is going to focus on the next few days.
Yeah, and it's been particularly damaging for Rishi Sunak for a couple of reasons. One, really highlighted by Keir Starmer as well, because it says something about his leadership and the fact that it took him 2 weeks to reach the point where he suspended the party's support for these two Tory candidates when we first broke the story in The Guardian, the next day he said he was disappointed. And then there was more revelations and he said he was angry about it. And yet it took him two weeks to reach the point where he was so disappointed and angry that he actually decided that he shouldn't be representing the party anymore. And that's problematic, particularly when compared to Starmer's quick action when it came to this Labour candidate who, as you say, placed a bet against himself. So it wasn't illegal. It was just probably daft, but nevertheless was suspended immediately after the Labour Party established that he was being investigated by the Gambling Commission. And the second reason I think it's so damaging for Sunak is that he came into office promising a different type of leadership from the from that which had immediately gone before, primarily Boris Johnson with Partygate and some of the other scandals surrounding him, Chris Pincher and so on, but then also obviously briefly Liz Truss. And I think for the most part, people felt that he had sort of, you know, he had a higher level of standards, that probity and ethics and so on were, you know, he wasn't quite of the same, cut from the same cloth as Boris Johnson. And what this scandal has shown is that because it's happened on his watch, that in the public's minds, is he any different from the Tory leaders that have gone before? And that, I think, ultimately is really damaging in part and is why this in particular has really cut through with so many people and so many people out there.
And let me just sum that up finally with a quote from the political professor, Phil Cowley, who has been furiously retweeting one of his own pieces today, but partially because it chimes so well with this scandal. And this is something he wrote in Prospect magazine a little while ago about a different political scandal. I think this one was Partygate. But he wrote, "The better sort of political scandal must be easy to understand. It should not center on matters of public policy because that runs the risk of everything becoming complicated. Rather, it must be about base human frailties, the sort everyone can relate to. Hypocrisy, deceit, greed, lust. Bonus points for more than one." and that's, I think, exactly why this has cut through, because it's one of those things that people understand. They don't really have to have any arguments about it. They understand why it's bad, and it's pretty straightforward.
And we saw that all of that, of course, played out on the very public stage tonight of the final head-to-head leadership debate of this election campaign. Now, we've had one other head-to-head, and we've had a couple of sort of, you know, audience Q&As, presenter Q&As as well. So we've got very used to sort of them punctuating and actually really setting the tone for much of the campaign thus far. We've been here in my sitting room a few times, Kieran, late at night with Maz, our producer, you know, watching them and analysing them. But this is our last chance to do this. I mean, will you miss it?
I will miss it. Yeah. This. I'm going to be sad not to have my regular appointments in your front room.
Well, you have to come around and watch EastEnders instead.
We can commentate on the football together if you want.
All right, then.
That'll be a new podcast, but I think that might kind of cross others that The Guardian has. But I think this is a good point, actually, to think about what we've learned over the course of several of these televised head-to-heads, Q&As, debates, whatever. And the thing that one main thing that jumped out at me from tonight, looking at what has happened, I think, to Keir Starmer over the course of this campaign, is he has gone from being the leader of the opposition to the presumptive prime minister. And I don't think he's quite adjusted for that yet. So I think a lot of the way that Keir Starmer had prepared for these debates was by doing the same, I made this point last time, but the same kind of preparation he would do for Prime Minister's questions, where he is the one asking questions, where he is the one holding the government to account. And all he has to do is prove that they're feckless, useless, you know, they've got another policy wrong, they're corrupt, whatever. And he's landed his punches and he can then walk away. And when Rishi Sunak turns around and says, "Yes, but what would you do differently?" he doesn't really have to answer the questions. During this campaign, on nights like tonight, I think you saw suddenly the audience does not regard that as being enough. They want to hear more from him because he is essentially being treated as the prime minister. So you saw moments, for example, where the two leaders were debating their migration plans.
Which means, to be clear, most of them will be given asylum. They will get the right to remain in this country.
At the moment, 100% of them are effectively being granted asylum in this country because they can't go anywhere. They can't go anywhere. They cannot. The Prime Minister knows this, and if he thinks I'm wrong, he should say so. Because they're not being processed, they cannot be returned to where they came from. Can they, Prime Minister? If he wants to correct
now's his chance to do it.
They cannot be returned.
Well, do you know where these people come from?
No, he's not answering the question.
Do you know where they come from? Iran,
you can see.
Syria, Afghanistan. So when Keir Starmer says he's going to return people, is he going to sit down? Are you going to sit down with the Iranian Ayatollahs? Are you going to try and do a deal with the Taliban? It's completely nonsensical what you are saying, right?
Now, I have to say, probably Starmer's is a little bit more credible than Sunak's, simply because Sunak's rests on the Rwanda plan, which has not worked so far, and I think most experts do not expect to work, certainly in terms of stopping the small boats. But it was Keir Starmer who came off looking like he didn't really have the answers, looking kind of caught up in tangles, looking like he was avoiding the question. And I think the reason for that is because people are kind of holding him to a higher standard now, and he realizes that he's actually going to have to implement this stuff. So he can't just get away with saying, well, their Rwanda plan doesn't work, because he now has to come up with his own answers. Contrast that, however, with Rishi Sunak, who I think is able to say all kinds of things and has been able to say all kinds of things during this campaign and on debate stages like tonight, and get away with them because nobody thinks he's going to be prime minister. So he can promise the pension triple lot plus. And Keir Starmer tries to say, well, how are you going to pay for it? But the kind of debate has moved on because nobody thinks they're going to do it. He can promise £46 billion worth of national insurance cuts. He can promise a return to national service. Nobody thinks any of this is going to happen. So what we saw tonight, I think, to a certain extent, was Rishi Sunak dance rings around Keir Starmer at points, because that is the luxury of opposition. Sunak now has it. Starmer no longer does.
And as we were watching the debate tonight, there was one moment where we both caught each other's eye when one of the audience members, Robert, asked a question.
Good evening, gentlemen. Mr. Sunak, I think you made a fair job of being Chancellor, but you're a pretty mediocre Prime Minister. Sir Keir, I think that your strings are being pulled by very senior members of the Labour Party. Are you two really the best we've got to be the next Prime Minister of our great country?
And I think the reason we caught each other's eye, Kieran, was because it's something that we've picked up out and about on the doorstep and across the country as well, is that nobody is feeling particularly inspired by either of the options available. Now, it's clear that right across the country, there are lots of people that feel that they want to give the Tories a kicking. And we've seen that reflected in polls throughout the contest, and will no doubt see that reflected on election night as well. But they're not yet, as we've said before, they're not yet sold on Labour. Labour isn't sort of the scary prospect it was to some key swing voters back in 2019. But they haven't really sort of captured the imagination and given people the sort of, you know, reason for hope that they might otherwise have. And what's really clear, both in our conversations anecdotally, are what we're witnessing on the doorsteps and what we're seeing in some of the polling and focus groups, is that voters are feeling pretty disaffected. It's that sort of plague on all your houses mentality, and that feeling that you know, all politicians are the same and aren't really able to offer anything that will, you know, hope that their lives will get better. And it's a problem for Labour, that, because they have framed this whole election campaign around quite a small target. They admit that they haven't been particularly ambitious when it comes to the scale of the promises, but they argue that they can't be, because were they to come in and offer a whole range of policies, like, for example, plucking an example out of the air, Keir Starmer's leadership pledges, the public wouldn't believe they'd be able to deliver them, partly because they've been let down so many times on the big promises, Brexit, levelling up and so on, but also because of the state of the economy. Nobody thinks that there's any room, any money to spare. I mean, you've got organisations like the IFS, the Institute for Fiscal Studies think tank, warning that both of the main parties are engaged in conspiracy of silence as to how their sums are going to add up and what cuts are going to have to come. So the prospect of a Labour Party coming in and offering big promises, radical change, big spending and hope, were remote at the start of this campaign. So, you know, it was kind of almost like a lose-lose from them, that one.
To a certain extent, and it is noticeable, I think, that Keir Starmer got applause when he said that people feel, I think he said the quote was, people feel hope has been beaten out of them. And that did actually earn applause from the audience. So clearly there is that feeling of that.
I think this question of enthusiasm is really important that you put to us, because I'm not surprised that after 14 years of this, people feel that the hope's been beaten out of them, because the country is in such a state. They've had loads of promises made to them at the last election about what would happen, which haven't been delivered on. That does beat the hope out of people. The very first question was about integrity in politics. And again, people haven't seen that integrity.
But, you know, we've discussed this before. I think people, even if they feel the hope has been beaten out of them, they're still looking for someone to give them some
a more. Vision, maybe.
I think they're looking for hope. I think they want someone to say things can get better, to coin a phrase. And I think Keir Starmer's not very good at saying it. But look, the other thing that you mentioned, which I think is really worth us paying attention to, because it has cropped up several times in the last few days in my conversations with Tory and Labour candidates, is this huge chunk of undecided voters, much bigger than normally it would be this far out from an election. And nobody knows quite why they're staying still, that they're undecided. Are they genuinely undecided? Are these shy Tories? Are these shy reform voters? Or are they going to stay at home? They are unlikely, I think, to be shy Labour voters, I think, at this point. Anybody who has decided to vote Labour, you know, is quite happy to say so. But I wonder whether the surprise that we get, and there usually is some kind of surprise in there in the exit poll and on election night, is a much stronger showing for reform than we were expecting. And I just point you the direction of another MRP, I'm afraid, but there's quite interesting. One out tonight showing, first of all, I mean, showing unbelievably Labour on 450 seats. You just can't imagine what Parliament would look like that. But also Reform on 18 and the Tories behind the Lib Dems as, you know, the main party of opposition. That would be a dramatic result, but I think Labour will have their eye on that reform vote, because who knows what will happen to those voters. Will they go back to the Tories, in which case the Tories become a plausible election force again, or will reform use that as a platform to start eating into all of that Labour vote, which have come over for this election? But as we're mentioning, and as we heard tonight, I think, on the debate stage, somewhat reluctantly, not with great enthusiasm, not with great hope. And it's those kind of people that I think could be peeled off if reform really do start getting an electoral foothold across the country.
And I suppose we should also probably turn to turnout as well and what that's likely to be at the general election. So last time, that winter's day in December 2019, turnout was 67%. It was down a little on 2017, but it was substantially up on the low of 59.4% for the UK general election in 2001. So, you know, we've had an apparently uninspiring campaign from Labour. Certainly, that's what lots of people seem to believe. It seems clear where the winning party is going to be, and there's high levels of voter distrust. So, you know, is a summer's day in 2024 going to be the moment to attract people to the polling station? Maybe they'd rather be down the park having an ice cream or a beer. So, you know, we don't yet know what turnout's going to be, but it does feel that apathy might end up being reflected in people not coming out at all, and that therefore that would put a even more of an onus on those that are decided, and that may be those people that, you know, want to move away from the Conservatives potentially to reform, and the impact that could have in you know, in numerous seats which are currently regarded as a knife edge right across the country.
And just feeding into that feeling of a lack of enthusiasm, I think, is to a certain extent the habit of Keir Starmer of trying not to get embroiled in too many fights. Now, this isn't all over the place. I mean, he's obviously taken on his own party in lots of ways. But as a general rule, when it comes to policy, he would rather compromise, I think, than stick to his guns and find himself in an potentially unpopular position. But when he does decide that he's going to stick to his guns, I think this is really where he is at his best. And I think you saw that tonight in his answer on trans rights and female-only spaces. This was the moment for me where he felt he had a position that was different from Rishi Sunak's, that he could justify, and that he was willing to justify, even if he was going to mean alienating some of the audience.
What I will also say is that I do recognise that there are a small number of people who are born into a gender that they don't identify with, and I will treat them as I treat all human beings, with dignity and respect. And I'll tell you for why. I'll tell you for why. Because if you don't, you end up with the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom standing in Parliament making an anti-trans joke in front of the mother of a murdered trans teenager. I will never, ever allow myself to be put into that position.
Okay.
And I think beyond Starmer's willingness to take really quite a strong position on this, for me, it wasn't just about the fact of access to women's only spaces and the fact that both men said that they would protect those. It went beyond the issue about trans rights even, to the point that Starmer has made a couple of times now, and I actually think articulates quite well, about how polarised this country has become in the last decade over all sorts of issues. And I think we saw it particularly, I mean, I think a lot of people think it started with Brexit. I would, as a Scot, go back further than that and say that it started with the Scottish independence referendum, when people felt so strongly about the issue on both sides that it actually sort of opened up a divide between, I mean, not just different groups of in the community, but also within families as well. It happened with Brexit too. And, you know, it got very, very angry, I remember, back in sort of like 2019, around the time of the Brexit, so-called Brexit wars in Parliament. But what we've seen since then with successive Conservative governments is picking an issue which feels like it's, you know, a point of division. And Starmer made this point in the debate, rather than finding things that bring people together. Now, he said we shouldn't be using trans rights as a political football. And it's hard to get away from the fact, even though you get people like Kayleigh Badenoch saying this is not about culture wars, do we believe it? No. This is not about culture wars. This is about an issue that many women feel very strongly about. Yes, many people, many women do feel very strongly about this issue, but don't want it to be used, you know, to divide, and would rather that we took a sort of a much more serious approach that you know, leaders saw it as being incumbent on them to bring people together. We haven't seen a lot of that in recent years. And for me, hearing those words from Starmer, I actually think was quite powerful and an indication, hopefully, that he will be serious in delivering on bringing people closer together again.
And let me just contrast that actually with the answer I think both men gave to what I thought was an absolutely hopeless question on immigration. There was a man in the audience who stood up and said, "We're an island. Why is it so hard to close our borders?" I mean, the honest answer to that is because the economy would collapse if we literally closed our borders overnight. What are you talking about? There is not even reform is talking about closing our borders. They're talking about freezing net migration, which would still mean hundreds of thousands of people coming in to replace the emigration each year. I would have loved to see Keir Starmer take that on and just say, that is a nonsense question. I mean, he didn't. It wouldn't have had to have been personally vituperative about it. But I think that he can, at times like that, say, "I'm really sorry, but what you're saying does not make sense." And that moment, just to go back into the trans debate, where he said to Rishi Sunak, "Read the legislation. What you're saying that you want to do is already in there." Mm-hmm. When somebody like Keir Starmer clearly has an interest in legislation and how government works, and when he knows his stuff, it's good to see him kind of fight for it and say, "That's not how this works. Sorry if you don't like this answer, but that's simply the case."
So this is the last of these debates. And as there has been with the others, there was a snap poll by YouGov straight afterwards, which puts the result. Can you guess what it was?
This time.
Who do you think won?
This time I know. It was 50-50. I mean, I would have guessed. If I hadn't known, I would have guessed 52-48. But that's the golden number.
That's the banter outcome, isn't it? But it was interesting. I thought that the biggest clap that Starmer got, and he got a few, as did Sunak, was when he effectively reminded people why they hated Rishi Sunak, why they hated the Tories.
Yeah.
And I kind of think that sums up this election in its entirety. That it's so much about people wanting to get rid of the Tories rather than what Labour can offer. But now the debates are wrapped up, and the party leaders, including, of course, the party leaders for the SNP, for Reform, for the Liberal Democrats, are back on the road for the final haul. I think, as somebody who's covered quite a lot of the gambling story, I think I wouldn't be surprised at all if we hear more allegations of political figures involved in this scandal. Rishi Sunak will be attacking Keir Starmer and the Labour Party. Actually, with quite a lot of personal focus, I think, on Keir Starmer. We heard a lot of that this evening in the debate about him changing his mind, not being able to deliver it, not being able to say what he was going to do. Saying that Labour wasn't being straight on taxes repeatedly. It was all about not surrendering to the Labour Party. So I think there'll be lots of attacks from the Tories, because that, frankly, is all they've got left in the armoury now. And I think with Starmer, we're likely to see him carrying that Ming vase gently across an increasingly slippy floor, with a reference, obviously, to Roy Jenkinson's comments about Tony Blair being too cautious in the run-up to the 1997 general election. We're going to see that writ large with Keir Starmer as he treads his way gently and very carefully towards the election finishing line.
So we'll be back in a couple of days' time for our last podcast before voting day itself. So I'm sure we'll discuss it a bit more then. But I can't quite believe that we've had almost all of the campaign already. It feels like it's one of those campaigns that's gone in fits and starts, that it's been dominated by stories nobody expected, from D-Day to gambling, and not on the stuff that we might have foreseen, questions about tax or, you know,
or any policy,
or
really.
Any policy. Mm. It's been very policy light. And essentially, well, I would say the polls haven't moved, but the polls have moved. It's just the gap between Labour and the Tories hasn't moved. So it's kind of had this, we've had this weird sense of stasis for a lot of the campaign, even while there's been a lot of churn. The essential truth that this is a change election at which the government looks likely to change hasn't shifted at all.
Now, if you were an advisor or even had the ear of Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer right now, a week out from polling day, what advice would you give them each, Kieran?
Okay, well, there's advice for the last week of the campaign, and then there's advice for after the campaign. Let's advice for the last week of the campaign. I mean, look, you know, if you're advising Starmer, it's just carry on doing what you're doing. Doesn't seem to be going wrong, so just do that. Mm. I'm sure both.
Don't drop the vase.
Don't drop the vase. But this is not a man who looks in any way like he's about to drop the vase.
Yeah.
I'm sure both of them will do one of those desperate 24-hour stints of campaigning towards the end, which I absolutely hate. I think they're completely pointless, gimmicky, and make the future prime minister completely exhausted the first day they come in. But there you go. They'll feel duty-bound to do it. I think the advice for after the election for Starmer is have some goodies up your sleeve. Give us something good on day one, day two, day three. Whether that's, you know, I mean, we have obviously had in the past with changes of government, establishment, well, independence for the Bank of England, establishment of the OBR, that kind of thing. Have a couple of big policy announcements that tells people what kind of prime minister you're going to be. And for Sunak, I'd say, look, at this point, it's about saving your party. Do everything you can to save your party. There'll be a bit of, you know, warn people about the dangers of Labour's tax rises, you know, voting reform, all the rest of it. But really, I think Sunak now should focus on how do we stop our party being completely eaten up by reform? And the answer is get round your MPs and say, look, you guys are going to have to keep this guy out. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would almost make the focus of their campaign for the next 7 days just attack Farage. Just do it constantly. Try and undermine him now, because if we end up in a position where reform has 18 to 20 seats, that's a real building block for them to start going after the Tories in a serious way during the next parliament. So
yeah, not just
it's existential for them.
And not just existential for the Tories, but also the rise of the populist right, as we're seeing right across Europe.
Absolutely.
Is deeply worrying. And if we see it happening here, then that's a problem for all of us.
Yeah. All right. So what would yours be? Go on. What's your advice for both men?
So I would say a week out for the campaign, I would suggest to Keir Starmer that he's been so good at carrying the Ming vase, he's been so cautious, but he hasn't yet managed to provide that hope, to try and do that a little bit, to just inject a bit of optimism about the sort of change that he can deliver. And not just so that we all feel better about ourselves and therefore possibly more likely to vote for Labour, but also because he needs to have a positive mandate so that in difficult times, and there will be difficult times, probably not long after winning the general election, he can refer back to it. He needs a bit of that vision. So if he can do that, I don't know whether he's got it in him, but if he can do that and offer us a bit of hope, I think that'd be a really good thing. For Rishi Sunak, I think I'd echo everything that you've said, Kieran. I think those are really good points about recognising that he is going to lose. But as William Hague said way back at the beginning of the campaign, it is an honourable thing to lose well, and that he needs to leave his party in to be in some position to fight back from, rather than completely decimated. And key part of that is, of course, tackling the threat of Nigel Farage and reform. And for him, on a more personal level, I'd suggest that he could potentially pop round to the US embassy and see if he can get his green card back. I can't imagine it'd be, even though he said he's going to hang around for 5 years, regardless of whether he wins the election or not, I think we all expect him to disappear off to California.
I suspect he will fill the criteria quite easily. That will not be a problem for him regaining his green card.
So that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. If you want to get a daily fix of politics, make sure you listen to Today in Focus's Election Extra episodes. And John Harris is back on Friday this week, where he's been on the campaign in Boston, Lincolnshire, following the rise of Reform UK. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producer, possibly for the last time on my living room carpet, is Maz Ebtehaj. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.
Es ist schwierig, Ziele zu erreichen, wenn Ihre Teams keine klaren Prioritäten haben. Mit Asana, der Work-Management-Plattform für Unternehmen, befinden sich Aufgaben und Ziele am selben Ort. Dadurch verstehen Teams, wie ihre Arbeit Ziele unterstützt. Asana, a smarter way to work. Kostenlos unter asana.com testen. asana.com